Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Excuse me, I have a frog in my throat. This is Coach Chris with Critical Bench, and I have with me today Mr. Mike Gillette, the face of strength psychology. And Mike, this is your personal story. That's what this very unique product is based on. It's based on everything that you endured in your life and turned you into the man that you are today. And you have obviously a very interesting skill set to be able to share with the masses to help make them mentally tougher and just tougher in general in terms of how they go about living their life. And so let me just be the first one to say thank you so much for putting yourself out there like that, and we are absolutely thrilled to have you on the line with us today.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
And as you listeners probably already know, we have a relationship with Mike. We've done other things with him before, never something quite like this. It was typically more on his physical ability and the feats of strength and all that stuff, which is, tied in a little bit to this, obviously. But this really comes down to somebody who has been through so much in his personal life and then turned that into something that just drove him into all these other amazing things that he did, from the being in the Army as a paratrooper to a SWAT commander, martial arts, Masters Hall of Fame, counterterrorism work with the Department of Homeland Security, bodyguard to Fortune 500 and executives, and obviously in this phase of his life doing record-setting strongman feats of strength. And it's so impressive, obviously, the resume, but there's no one else quite like Mike, and that's why we want him to be able to answer questions about why is being tough so important in your life. And there's no one better on the planet to speak about stuff like this. So I have some pretty in-depth questions. We're going to get right to it here. Mike, young men obviously go through a lot of tough times from age 15 to 20. They're trying to figure out what kind of man they're going to be. And during this time, they get their first real job. They have their first meaningful relationship or relationships. They graduate high school. They select a college or potentially join the military, or they decide to jump right into the working world sometimes. If you could tell a young man two key things about how to face life and deal with the outside pressures of the real world, what would you say?
I like that. There's a lot of aspects to all of that. It's a challenging time to be a young man. And I think there's a lot of challenges that young men face with respect to just sort of navigating their way to what being a man means. So if I had two things to say to a man in that age range, I think the first one would be simply actually think about the kind of man you want to become. We have a culture that sort of fosters an extended adolescence. We have a lot of men who are really more boy-like in their thinking, in the things that they pursue. And I think young men need to be encouraged to think like men, to think about what it means to be a man. And then number two, don't let anyone talk you out of that. Because we have a culture that doesn't really encourage men to be men, to make strong decisions, to stand for something. Everyone sort of, goes along to get along, don't make waves. We're sort of a controversy-averse culture in some ways. We confuse disagreements with being disagreeable. We confuse taking a stand with being judgmental. And as a result, we don't have a lot of rugged individuals. And, the world needs more strong men, and strength starts on the inside.
No doubt about that. Wow, that's pretty cool, because when you say it, it sounds so simple. Think about what kind of man you want to become, and B, don't let anyone stop you from, you know, becoming that man. And it's amazing in life how we sometimes do end up kind of listening too much to what others think we should, you know, we should be doing with our lives, and don't pursue our dreams and pursue our manhood, you could say, in the way that we want to. So that's pretty great. And I think that's something, like you alluded to, that it wasn't that way. If you go back 50 to, you know, 60, 70 years ago, I think men had to grow up faster. And today we've allowed them to just kind of take their time, and it's worked against us.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of young men who are sort of languishing in boyhood, and there's confusion to a certain degree as to what, you know, desirable male qualities are, and, you know, being a strong person is not being a bully. Being someone who is firm in their convictions is not someone who is judgmental or intolerant. But we're not a culture that really handles disagreements well. You know, we tend to shout at each other until one person just gets tired and shuts up. We don't really engage in the vigorous intellectual debate very well. So what was once commonplace is just not that prevalent. And as a result, I think that when you do see a man who is strong and firm in his convictions, they tend to attract a lot of attention. There's something charismatic about that. People are drawn to that. People look for leaders to emerge, and you know, a leader is someone who is strong, who knows what they think, knows what they believe, and will communicate that, not in a unpleasant or inappropriate way, but strongly.
Yeah. Wow. Terrific. Well said. I like it. That's great insight. Moving on to some other very interesting questions. When I write a question, I write a paragraph. I can't just write a simple question. It just doesn't work that way. So for number two here, I wrote, choices define us in life, big ones and little ones. We can look the other way when we see someone else break the law. We can intervene when we see someone getting treated unfairly. We can decide to wake up early and get stuff done, or sleep in and play catch-up all day long but never actually get there. How closely connected are the big and little choices and their impact on us? And I guess I can kind of stop there, or I can just kind of continue, because, well, why don't I continue and and we can kind of talk around this topic. Does a minor variable such as sleep really determine the kind of life we are to live? Does looking the other way when someone else has been mistreated make us weak? Are mentally tough people just better at doing what's necessary or what's right, even when they may not like it?
Well, there's a lot of good stuff in there to potentially unpack. I like a lot of that, Chris. I'm going to get back to the very first part of the question, because I think it's sort of the linchpin upon which everything else rests.
Yes.
And I have, because I'm a more mature fellow, which is a polite way of saying I'm getting old,
right.
That simply means, Chris, that I have said some of the same things more than once. Anyone who's been in a teaching role or in a training role, you know, has, you know, a number of the same types of people that they come in contact with, and there are certain things that they find themselves, myself included, repeating to fresh ears. And one of them, and you know, this goes back to my days when I was a field training officer. In my days in law enforcement, I would train young law enforcement officers that were brand new, fresh out of the academy. And there was a phrase I kept hearing myself repeat, and it's appropriate in the context of your question, and that is, life is choices. And it really is. Everything that we are is sort of a sum total of the choices we make. We make big choices and little choices, like you alluded to, and how we deal with those choices has everything to do with who we are, the kind of person that we make ourselves into. So it's not just the big deal choices where people are clear on what the right course of action or what the wrong course of action might be, but it's the little things too. I was reading something recently that on the internet having to do with just habit and why it's important to make your bed every morning when you get up. Because it creates momentum. It creates the perception of productivity. If the first thing you do is take care of some business every day, then it's a lot easier to continue that momentum forward and continue to take care of other business throughout the day. And a lot of time management and self-help experts sort of allude to that type of thinking, but it makes sense. Now,
right.
I don't really care what your bed looks like, but I think there's wisdom in that. We are what we do. I mean, that goes back to Aristotle.
Right.
Aristotle said that the excellence is a habit. We are what we repeatedly do. And I think that's absolutely the case. Now, you gave a couple of examples of, you know, people that, look the other way or are perhaps more inwardly focused than externally focused. And those are sorts of aspects about how that type of decision-making, you know, can manifest. But when it comes to choices, that's what defines us. You know, with the old expression, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I think most of us want to be a good person, but being a good person requires, active participation in life. It requires work. It requires a conscious attention to that which should be attended to. And that all gets back to your decision-making. So one who makes strong choices is a strong person. That's why I will say strength starts on the inside. You know, not everyone is physically gifted. I know some very strong people mentally who have some type of physical limitation, but they are strong people.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, think of the strength it's required to somebody who has physical limitations, yet they just seem to will themselves to be able to do things. I mean, they're insanely strong. That their drive and their willpower and their passion for life is stronger than somebody else that's perfectly healthy in some cases. So
100%.
No, it's very cool, and it's that's kind of when I was coming up with that question. I was fairly certain I knew how you would answer it, but obviously, with your background, there's always a cool story, of why that question resonates with you. So, very cool. Moving on, I'm sure when anyone from 20 to 40 years old thinks back to our soldiers, American soldiers that fought in World War II, we think of some pretty tough guys, right? You know, we see there's famous statues and stuff like that of soldiers raising the American flag. There's all kinds of cool things that resonate, I think, with men and a tough soldier. Guys that had no choice but to fight a real-world threat on the other side of the world. But yet today, we're still dealing with threats from the other side of the world. But since the life we live today is so different from our grandfathers and great-grandfathers' generation, you know, the world we're in now, the computer age, is it safe to say that today's world is filled with mentally weak wimps? And I know that sounds a bit harsh, but it just feels as though the young men in the world today just don't have the mental toughness that existed a few generations back. Could you give some insight maybe on that question?
Okay. It is a harsh sounding diagnosis, but that doesn't mean that it is necessarily incorrect. And I think that if we had people from the 40s, these basically anyone from like 17-year-olds, to guys in their mid-20s that were being drafted or volunteered, en masse. And fighting for extended periods with limited equipment, the wrong kind of clothing, and all of the things that they endured, whether it was wintertime or the jungle, it was bad regardless. If they were to cast their eye towards the young men of the future, the young men of today, in this case, I think they'd be a bit shocked.
Yeah,
and It's not to say, that we're sort of, making one better or worse, but things are different. And regardless of your perspective on our, technology-based, highly evolved and very sensitive society, it's certainly different than how it was. And better or worse is something I will leave to social critics or theologians, but it's different. And it's different simply because I think that young men are more disconnected from certain parts of themselves than we used to be. And part of it is just sort of the way that society works. People were a lot more connected a few decades back. Neighborhoods were neighborhoods. People
yeah.
knew each other. There was a lot more social connectivity face-to-face. And I think there was more of a sense of collective responsibility in a given neighborhood for how things were going on. If there was a problem in the neighborhood, it wasn't just the person who was suffering from vandalism or whatever the issue was. The entire neighborhood would feel compelled to take some kind of action because everyone felt connected in that way. Conversely, and this is something I remember from my own childhood, if a young kid in the neighborhood was acting up, was doing something inappropriate, it was not inconceivable for a unrelated adult to not only yell at them, but possibly, give them a smack on the butt. And no parents were getting offended. No one was threatening to sue anyone else for touching my kid. It was just sort of an expectation.
Yeah.
Because the parent, would expect similar participation if their kid was the one that was acting inappropriately.
Absolutely.
So I think that there's that aspect. I mean, we socialize differently now. And you can look at a lot of factors. People don't work for the same company for the same extended periods that they used to. There's a lot more a vocational transition time that takes place. People move around a lot more. There's the whole issue of, families have been, redefined and redefined, much more fragmented. So a lot of the things, the factors that were present that made people a certain way are not present to the same extent that they used to be. And, good or bad, that's the reality of it. And
yeah.
it changes what form society sort of takes in a collective sense. Then there's the technology piece. I mean, we're ultimately very disconnected, Chris, from our physical selves in a way that is really unprecedented. What's ironic is I have read articles from the beginning of the last century, 1910s, 1920s, from people who were bemoaning the physical condition of young people in school and how if we didn't get a handle on that, we would not be strong enough to fight our enemies from abroad, whoever those enemies might be.
Right.
Kennedy picked up that theme some, 40, 50 years later, bemoaning, a further physical decline and, promoting the President's Council on Physical Fitness and so forth. So back when everyone seemed to be in really good shape, people were complaining about how not in shape kids were,
right.
which is
right.
unbelievable. compared to now, what you actually see is a redefining of the physical shape of young people. You know, the prevalence of crap that is both tasty and convenient to prepare has changed how people look. And that's not a body-shaming comment, whatever that phrase means. If you've got a physical issue because, you know, of what you put into your body, that's reality. It's not anyone being judgmental. It's something that should be fixed. It's in the best interest of the person afflicted. And so we're sort of afflicted by the convenience of certain types of foods, the convenience of not having to do a whole lot. I mean, everything we used to do was a lot more physical. I mean, we engaged with the outdoors. We thought it was fun. Nobody wants to go outside anymore. You know, it's hot, it's cold, there's bugs out there. There's nothing to compete with my video games outside. There's no place to plug them in. It's just different. So I think that, you know, between the sort of move, maybe that's the wrong word, but we've definitely devolved to a more sedentary culture.
Yeah.
We're putting a lot more crap in our body. You know, tasty though it may be, it's not helping us. And, you know, then when you take away some of these sort of institutional or social framework pieces that used to sort of create the sense of community cohesion, where everybody's kind of off on their own, it has fundamentally changed the landscape. And if I don't feel connected to you, then I don't feel compelled to intervene on your behalf. So when we see people not stepping up and doing things that, you know, require a little bit of backbone, it's not just because, you know, they may be weak or frightened. They just think we're fragmented. We're emotionally fragmented from each other in a way that's sort of unique. And I think it's a very recent sort of phase of, you know, how our society functions. That was kind of a high-level response. I don't know if that's what you're looking
no,
for,
that's...
but that's kind of – those are the types of factors that
– yeah.
Because I try to be pretty, clinical about this. It's not just, these kids today. You know,
yeah, right.
I don't want to sound like another crotchety old person just saying, you know, kids are weak and they don't know the value of a dollar or the value of hard work and on, because I do think that things have changed, and I think there's a variety of layers to why that is the case. And it's not a question of, you know, good versus bad. You know, we all have our opinions on what good versus bad is, but there's no question that we have a much different world, and the people populating it here on our own country are different than, our immediate ancestors.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Yeah, I've learned one thing with you, Mike, that I never try to anticipate the direction the answer is going to go, because I just, you know, I'm talking with somebody with a fairly high IQ who's also really educated. So I know it's going to be a much grander response than what I what I initially thought. So that was fantastic, and I do think it all really, a lot of it comes down to the men in the family. You know, it starts with the patriarch, and I think if you have that strength from dad in the family, that can really create that cohesive family unit. And if you have enough of those types of dads, in a particular neighborhood, that can become probably a pretty cool neighborhood. And I think that's where it starts. And if we had more of that going on, then we would probably be able to turn some things around. You know.
Yeah, and there's some directions that observation can go to, but I think you're absolutely correct with what you just said.
Yeah, that's obviously that's the uneducated, non-clinical response.
But that doesn't make it any less true.
That's right. Now, all guys know the guy who was more talented than anyone else in their school growing up, and I'm talking elementary, junior high, or high school. He could do anything he wanted physically, and it seemed almost effortless compared to, you know, his buddies. His talent for most things physical was just superior to everyone else's. But at a certain point, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. And you've probably heard that saying before. It's kind of a common phrase in some gym atmospheres. So if that's true, is mental toughness the most important aspect for any athlete attempting to become truly great at what they do? Does being mentally strong really determine the limits of our physical ability?
Great question. And the short, inelegant answer is yes. The longer answer is a longer explanation of why that's the case. I've seen this recently in two sort of diverging areas. In the first one, you use the example of that guy we know growing up, or maybe there's a couple of those guys we know, the guys that are just literally, you know, came out of the chute superstars. They're
yep.
fast. They're coordinated. It's like, what can't they do? And I was always fascinated by those people when I was a kid, because when I was a kid, you know, small, weak, not connected to the realm of athletics in any context. And they just seemed so sort of beyond. And I could never really figure out, well, why them? Why not me? You know, what is it? You know, was it the Wheaties for breakfast? I mean, I watched the commercials when I was a kid. And what I noticed is over time, and again, you know, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who's now 53, I run into some of these guys from my childhood, or, you know, from, you know, high school years,
right,
periodically, and I see some of these guys that were superstars, you know, some of these guys that went on to be D1 athletes, and I look at them now, and you would have no idea that they were ever physically gifted.
Mm-hmm.
Because all you see is lots and lots of neglect. They are walking around being unremarkable to the point of, you know, being overweight, you know, or they're hobbling around. You know, they've just got the infirmities that we associate with disuse. You know,
yeah.
I haven't exercised in so long that I'm walking like an old man now. You know,
that's
and
right.
These are guys that, you know, they're, you know, 50, 51, 52, 53, like I am, they're way too young to be looking and acting the way they are. I don't know, but my informal diagnosis is that if everything always sort of came easy to you in the physical realm, then I don't know how much value you placed on that. I don't know that you ever understood what the gift was, and that at some point the gift needs a little care and feeding.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are just complete naturals, and we all know these people, you know, male, female, we've been around them.
That's right.
If the person has never had to really push to have that, it's kind of like, I'm going to use a strange analogy. So often a boy band comes along. It's been happening for generations. They're super popular, and then they're not. And it has nothing to do with anything other than the cyclical nature of the entertainment industry, you know, and the demographics, the ages of their core audience, and how
yeah.
quickly that audience shifts from one thing to another thing. So there's an intense period of success, and then there's just crickets. And if you were a member of one of those boy bands, how perplexing would that be? Because you did the same thing for a period of time, and then suddenly you were hot. You continued to do the same thing, and suddenly you weren't hot anymore. You kept continuing to do the same thing, and no one cares. You don't really understand what it was that made you successful. I think that people who are physically gifted can be in that same sort of conundrum. You know, I was always this, I was always that, I always looked great, and now I look like poop. What happened?
Right. And, whereas, and no one and no one cares about me anymore. I'm not a big deal anymore.
Yeah, that's true too. That's another layer, a sad layer that we might lay on top of it. But compare that to somebody who was good enough physically, but mentally would just outwork everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would just go and go and go. And those are the people, I think, where it sticks. Where, you know, you look at them today, they still look as good as any 50-year-old, as any 60-year-old has a right to look. Because they beat it into themselves. You know, they forged themselves into that athlete. You know, that person who could do X, Y, Z. And the person who can forge themselves into that is the mentally tough athlete. And now here's the other sort of disparate example. I'm presently working with a gymnastics club. It's a high-level club, one of the top 10 clubs in the nation. They've got lots and lots of, and these are girls, which for people who look at the scary pictures of me on the internet, it might be a little hard to fathom. But they're very tough, and they're not afraid of me anymore. So,
that's right.
These are kids, you know, 14, 15, they already have their D1 scholarships in the bag. They're really gifted. But the ones that truly excel are the ones who are mentally tough. And you can look at some of these athletes, and it's an interesting thing. We look at a person's book or their DVD, and you know maybe this person's super strong or they're super muscular, and it's like, this is what I did to get this way. And we say, okay, great, I'm gonna try that out. What's interesting, if you look at the world of competitive athletics, what you typically see are a group of people who do all the same thing. And in the world of gymnastics, you have a group of athletes. They all do the same thing every day, day in, day out, and yet you still have a diversity of body types. Because there's no getting around that. Now, you have plenty that appear to be the cliche gymnast physique, you know, short, dense, solid muscles, you know, kind of wide. They look like they can pick up a balance beam and beat you with it.
Right.
And then there are some that sort of defy that. There are some that are kind of skinny. There are some that don't really look that strong, but they can still, you know, go and do everything else. Those are the kids who just want it so bad that they are wringing every ounce of potential from their less than ideal physiques. That comes from mental toughness. You know, those are the kids that are going to just get themselves there any way they can. You know, the desire is tremendous. Now, of course, there is that perfect storm athlete, and every sport has these, where, you know, physical giftedness is combined with a terrifying work ethic. And when you have that, then you don't want to compete against those people because they will just be unstoppable.
Yeah, I actually
but
thought
it's a really
of that
cool thing
as
to
you were,
see.
It is. It's actually, that's that person that just at all levels, and I'm a big follower of all kinds of sports, and, you know, I love college basketball. That's the person that just excelled at their high school, dominated in college, and then let's just say they went on to the NBA and they just are you know, just crushing it right from the get-go. That's just that perfect storm that, comes, it's your Michael Jordans, your Tiger Woods type of guy, you know, it's just, they're just here and there, and it's easy to pick those two out, but you know, there's obviously lots of others that are, you know, in the current world of sports. Well, and moving on, just because I don't want the people to not hear about you talk about fear, because fear is a huge part of mental toughness. And so my question is, the topic of fear is so compelling, because we all have them. We all have fears on some level. some of us fear seemingly harmless things like performing karaoke, public speaking, or interviews like this. Some of us have real powerful forms of fear, like a fear of heights, fear of confrontation, or snakes. Fear can be physically dangerous to us or simply emotional. But both can be very real to the person feeling them. What three things, and I, you know, see if you can come up with three things quickly, can someone tackling a fear-based situation do right away to help them deal with that fear and potentially work through it and overcome it?
Great question. A challenge to sort of distill down to something that quick. Just because there's sort of a myriad of issues that can feed into that. I think that when we're talking about fear, Chris, the first thing that's important is to be very honest with oneself. And it's fear is a challenging topic, particularly for males. Guys are not always honest with themselves. They, particularly when it relates to things that they perceive as shortcomings. And I don't think that there's any guy who has a fear of something that they're proud of. Hey, did I ever mention what I'm afraid of? It's a long list. And guys are not going to initiate that conversation.
Yeah,
you know,
that's not hanging out. That's not hanging out at the bar having a beer with your buddy talking
talking
about that. Yeah.
So the first thing is to open yourself up to what is true. And it is true. Everyone has things that they're afraid of. Even the most hardened, courageous men among us have something that they don't want to lose. So when that's the case, you know, I'm not afraid of anything. Well, do you have a home? Do you have a spouse? Do you have kids? Oh, yeah. Okay. Sometimes it's so external to you, you don't think about it, but there's something there, and there's generally a few things for most people. So understand that it exists. Then identify it. What specifically exists? What is it that we're afraid of? And some of them are kind of rational. You know, we have members of the armed forces who are deployed overseas in harm's way. Do you think they're afraid? Of course. Is that fear reasonable? Of course it is. If it were absent, might that indicate a potential problem? Yeah. Somebody who's not afraid in combat is prone to getting themselves or someone else hurt because they're not really acting in accordance with the risks involved. So we need to just sort of open ourselves up to the existence of fear. Then we need to identify what our own fears are, or if there's a couple of them, what's the one that really seems to be getting in the way?
Yeah.
Then when we know what fear is getting in the way, and as you pointed out, Chris, it can be things that are fairly innocuous. You know, the fear of public speaking, everyone uses, I use that frequently as an example. It's a good one. And I think that the best thing is, from that point on, is to figure out, well, what's the plan here? How are we going to deal with this? And some people have the goal of making fears go away. I think that's unrealistic. I think that your mind also realizes it's unrealistic, and there's a thing about dealing with anything mind-related, and that is you cannot lie to you. Your mind knows when you are BSing it. So when people say things like, and these are well-meaning people, but when people say things like, well, you know, you just have to think positive. You just have to, you know, do this thing or that thing. If it doesn't feel like that's the right thing for you or if that's realistic for you, your mind subconsciously is going to reject that notion.
Mm-hmm.
So So you can't lie to you. You can't act as though everything is okay if it's not okay. You need to at least address it. And I think that one of the things that more people are afraid of than they realize are negative, well, let's not even call them negative. Let's call them difficult emotions. That's a phrase I learned from a hypnosis trainer named Craig Siegel, and I like it a lot. Difficult emotions, because all emotions have something potentially to offer in terms of instruction.
Yeah.
So people don't like to feel sad. As an example, people will do any number of things to avoid feeling sad. You know, they drink, they distract themselves with choices that may not be, healthy for them in the long run, or they just do immersive activities to keep their minds engaged, video games or, whatever it happens to be.
To kind of sidetrack themselves from that,
absolutely.
That is. Yeah.
It's just kind of a little temporary anesthesia from, whatever is going on because they didn't want to feel sad. I propose something kind of radical. If you're experiencing a difficult emotion, maybe you could just experience it.
Wow.
Just, hey, there it is.
If
your girlfriend has left you and you feel bad, maybe you should.
Yeah.
Because that reflects that this was important. If the first inclination is, well, I guess I have to go and get drunk for 3 days and just kind of numb myself out, well, I don't think there's a lot of learning there. I don't think that whatever it was that may have led to her leaving, it may have been because she's a crappy person. It may be because you're a crappy person. It may be that you were not well suited for each other. But you're not going to come to any sort of sense of clarity if all you do is hide from the unpleasantness.
Yeah.
We as a culture, Chris, do not in these modern times do not do difficult things well. We tend to avoid them. And then we tend to rationalize our inability to confront difficult things, whether it's emotional or we were talking physical earlier, with all sorts of, very compelling, well-reasoned sounding ways. But the bottom line is we don't do difficult well, and that's not the hallmark of a tough person. A tough person can handle the negativity that comes from some of the situations that life will throw at us, the loss that one has to deal with when a loved one dies. Sometimes you just have to experience difficult emotions. If people don't handle things like that, okay, because death, separation, those are inevitable things. That's just a byproduct of life on this planet. And if you cannot deal with that, then eventually you're going to find yourself shrinking away from other things that cause disappointment. And many things that can cause disappointment are things that are amazing if they work. One of the reasons that I've done some things which are unique is because I'm not talented, I'm not necessarily smart, I can take it. I can handle whatever the cost is, whatever the pain is.
Yeah.
I can endure things. And I believe it is the capacity to endure that sometimes is the greatest talent of all. Because it allows me to hang on long enough until I get that thing.
Right. Yeah, and if anyone listening hasn't read your personal story on the Psychology of Strength page, then they should, because that would give them a little bit of a blueprint for your ability to endure because of what you endured for so many years of your childhood and even in your early adulthood. And when you go through so many difficult situations and then I think it just prepares you for the next difficult situation. You just handle things better. You know?
Everything is context. You know, I had a boss about 10 years ago who used to be a squadron commander for Delta Force. Okay, so anyone doesn't know what that is the Army's top secret anti-terrorism force. And sometimes they call it the unit when they make a TV show about it. Now, because they made a TV show about it, how top secret is it really? Not very. But anyway, when I worked for this guy after he had retired from active duty service, I found that he was not particularly tolerant of excuses or much of anything that didn't have to do with getting the job done. And people would approach him and they would say, well, you know, I'm dealing with this or I'm dealing with that. And he'd say, look, and this was in Las Vegas. So generally he would look outside and the sun would be shining because that's what it does in Las Vegas. He said, look, the sun is shining and no one is shooting at you. I don't want to hear about it. So depending on your life experience, some things can seem like a big problem. For him, many things didn't seem like a problem at all, because of his own life experience.
Right.
So when you've confronted things that are difficult, you are mentally stronger. When we're talking about fear, to sort of tie that up, what's important is to acknowledge its existence, identify what specifically you're dealing with, because until you do that, you're not really going to be able to formulate a plan for handling it. You know, maybe it's something that has to do with your own personal safety, but so many times it's just something that has to do with your comfort level, you know, your ego, you know, saving face, just doing things that are unpleasant or difficult. And if they're merely unpleasant, well, that's doable. You know, we can handle that. We just have to choose to.
Yeah.
And if it involves dealing with something that's unpleasant, then, you know, deal with it. You know, take it. You can handle it. We're just out of practice.
That's right. That's exactly right. We just have to practice by putting ourselves in those situations and then realizing once we come out the other side, oh, wow, how many times do you hear somebody who did something they had strong anxiety about, serious nervousness about, and they go, oh, that really wasn't that bad afterwards.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah,
I
know.
I can't believe I waited this long to do it. That's another one.
They built it up into their head, into this monster that was like something they could not accomplish. And then, oh, that really wasn't that bad. Why did I waste a whole year like stressing myself out about that? And then boom.
Right.
So, I mean, and a lot of things in life are that way. And now that's great. I really appreciate your insight on that, because I know, as I stated, we all face fears on some level. And to be able to listen to somebody who's dealt with his own set of fears and how he's come out on the other side and dealt with them and overcome them and moved on, that's fantastic. Well, you know, thank you. We could talk for hours. We already have. I'd love to continue the conversation. But I just really appreciate your time and your ability to really dissect some of these questions. And I know I've gotten a lot out of it and enjoyed it. I hope the listeners all have. And folks, this is Mr. Mike Gillette of Strength Psychology. He's one in a billion. There's really no one else like him. And we really hope that you're able to check that out and really hopefully change your lives because of all the wonderful things and tools that Mike is able to give you. Thank you so much, Mike, for your time.
Thanks so much, Chris.